Shalom, Havarim. Hello, friends. Oh, wow, that's weak. Weak stuff right there. Still, the tryptophan, the turkey, is that all still processing? I don't know how long it stays in your bloodstream. Maybe you're still a little bit asleep. I hope everybody had a wonderful Thanksgiving. I hope all your favorite teams won all your favorite sports games and all of that. At least half the people here are disappointed, and the other half don't care. Hopefully you all had a lovely time, and hopefully nobody used the word impeachment during your Thanksgiving dinner, and everything went well. I heard some interesting news, though, about the original Thanksgiving. You know the story, you know the history, the pilgrims and the Native Americans, they got together to celebrate this first big harvest. Well, some new historical information was unearthed recently, and they found out, are you ready for this? They found out what kind of music they listened to at the first Thanksgiving. Yeah, no, true. Okay. They found out what kind of music. Do you have any guesses what kind of music the pilgrims listened to at the first Thanksgiving? They listened to Plymouth Rock. Oh. I promised my family that I wouldn't tell any more bad jokes, but I just can't quit cold turkey. All right. That's enough for now. All right. So Thanksgiving is behind us, and today is my opportunity to wish you all a Happy New Year. Happy New Year, everyone! All right, Happy New Year. And I know you're thinking, wait a second, Marlene just said today's the 1st of December, and all at once you're trying to move us forward to New Year. But wait a second, I'm not talking about our calendar year, I'm talking about the liturgical year. Today is the first Sunday of Advent, and the liturgical calendar officially begins today. The liturgical calendar differs a little from our calendar year. We start every year with Advent, and for those that are really into these sorts of things, this is Advent Year A. Advent A1 is today. So Advent. We will move from Advent, you know, the next season. It's just Christmas or the Epiphany season. Following Christmas, we will come to Lent in a few weeks. We're already talking about Lent. Following Lent, we'll move into Pentecost. And then after Pentecost, there's this really fancy phrase that we use to describe the time between Pentecost until we get back to Advent. And he gets it up there. What do we call that time between Advent and Pentecost? Some very creative people name this, and they call it Ordinary Time. I have a friend in the United Methodist Church. Whenever he greets people during ordinary time, he says, Happy Ordinary Time, Marlene. How creative. So ordinary time is simply the time between Pentecost, so we loop back up to Advent. Pentecost is the time when we celebrate the church and the work that the church has done and is doing. Lent is a period leading up to Easter, when we practice this thing called repentance. And we think about the things that we've done wrong and the forgiveness that Jesus provides for us. The Christmas season stretches from Advent until Epiphany Sunday. It's those 12 days of Christmas when your true love gave to you all those things like a partridge in a pear tree. And of course, Advent is a season of... I'll tell you later. No, so Advent is a period of what? It's a period of waiting. We wait on the arrival of Jesus. Now, wait a second, Jesus came like 2019 years ago. Oh, we're not simply awaiting the arrival of a baby Jesus. We're waiting on the arrival of Jesus the King. So this year for Advent, Marlene mentioned it, we have this Advent series that we're working through, and it's simply called, What Are You Waiting For? So I could ask you this question, just like Marlene asked the children, what are you waiting for? Maybe you have been waiting to play Christmas music and set up your Christmas tree until after Thanksgiving. You say, no, not at your house. Some of you didn't wait that long. Maybe you're like me and you're waiting until the new year to start that diet. Maybe you're waiting to reconnect with family and friends that you haven't seen in a long time. Maybe you're waiting to tell someone that you haven't seen for a while that you love them. Maybe you're waiting to hear from someone else, I forgive you. Maybe you are waiting to hear that loved one say, I'm ready for help. Can you help me? My friends, the thing about Advent is this isn't necessarily the most upbeat and cheerful time of year. Because this is also a time of year when a lot of people are hurting. A lot of people are suffering. And the holidays can be extremely difficult for some people. So I know that we usually have these fun and bouncy sermons with a lot of jokes, and there still will be some jokes today. We're still going to go on random tangents because that's who I am and what I do. But today, we're just going to recognize that there's suffering in this world. I'm sure there's suffering in each of your lives as well. And we are waiting for the day when that is better. So let's start by looking at our scripture for today. Because we are in Advent, we do often read both an Old Testament and New Testament passage. And the passage that Paxton read for us today is from the prophet Isaiah. In Isaiah, the beginning of this book, the first 39 chapters are all about setting these people up for the Babylonian exile. The Babylonians have come in, they have captured Jerusalem, they have captured the temple, they have taken away all the treasures. These people are going to be made to pick up and move to a foreign land, a place where they don't know, and living in places and homes that they aren't familiar with, removed from their worship place, the temple. All of this is going on, and Isaiah pronounces it in the beginning of this prophecy. But then in chapter 2, we get just a little glimpse of hope. This is what Isaiah says. Isaiah 2:2, he says, "In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it." We in the church, we say this is something that is yet to come. This is something that is still going to be in our future. And I know we can look at this and say, well, it's talking about the Lord's temple. And doesn't Revelation talk about how there won't be any temple? Either way, this is just a metaphor. And I think what's going on here, if you think where's the Lord's temple here, it's on the highest of the mountains. And the idea is that if God is up in the sky, and I don't think God is really up there and we're down here, God is everywhere. But if the idea is that God is up in the sky, this temple reaches as high as possible, and the heavens and the earth come together. And it says down here, I love this last line, it says, all nations will stream to that temple. All nations will come to that place where heaven and earth meet. When we look at that word nations, I think we need a little bit of a Hebrew lesson today. Thank you. And not only getting Hebrew, you're getting Hebrew, Greek, and some weird English as well thrown in here. So, my early Christmas present to you. The word that is translated there as nations, you've probably heard this one before. The word is goyim. Everybody say goyim. Goyim. My backdoor neighbors are Jewish, and they refer to me as goyim. Goyim means more than just the country like the U.S. or Canada or Mexico. Goyim is a synonym for the Greek word ethnos. Now everybody say ethnos. These words are interchangeable, and ethnos is where we get the word ethnicity from. So it too can be translated as nation or people group or Gentiles. So when my Jewish neighbors refer to me as goyim, they're referring to me as a Gentile. So if you look at this passage again, what it's saying is when heaven and earth come together in this metaphorical temple, it's not just the Hebrew people. It's not just the people of one certain background that come to this temple. It's people of every nation, color, creed, whatever it might be. All are invited to come to this mountain of God, to this place that God has established. Even goyim, like me, I'm going to guess most of you as well. This is good news to those of us that were not born Jewish people. We have been included in this promise. That's awesome. Now, when's that going to happen? All right. Well, I don't think it has happened yet. If you look at Jesus, it's always a good idea to look at Jesus. When you look at Jesus, I think it's interesting. If you look at our passage for today, if you just back up one chapter sooner, we find this. One chapter earlier, in Matthew 23:37. Again, Jesus saying this, "How often I wanted to gather your people together, just as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings." This is Jesus looking out over the city of Jerusalem, and he just wants to just bring everybody together and have a big old chicken hug, I guess it is. I've had a chicken leg or two, but I've never had a chicken hug. He just wants to bring together and have that protection and care for them. And it seems to be this fulfillment of the vision that Isaiah had, that nations from all around the world would come together. And Jesus says, I want to gather you together in this way. And this is what sets up the passage for us from Matthew 24 that Cindy read for us a few moments ago. Now, here's the thing about Matthew 24. I don't know what to make of it, because I've seen so many people fight over this stuff. I've heard so many bad sermons. I've heard so many hurtful podcasts or radio programs that talk about the end of the world. And I know we talked about this a little bit a couple of weeks ago when I preached on a different passage or somewhat similar. But you know what? I think that we all have differing opinions on these matters. And when was the last time you heard somebody fighting about premillennialism or postmillennialism or amillennialism? I mean, it's not for those of you that are probably under 30. It wasn't a big part of your coming up years. But those of you that are, say, 60 and up, are you familiar with those arguments? So are you a pre-tribulation post-amillennialist or a premillennialist, post-tribulation? I don't even know how it goes. People used to argue about these things, and they would split over them. Churches literally split over premillennialism, post-millennialism, pre-tribulation, post-tribulation. When will the world end? These things have to happen. I, for one, believe that the passage that Cindy read for us doesn't refer to a rapture like so many people have said. But you know what? If it turns out I'm wrong, I don't care. Because here's the thing, my friends. I trust God. I trust that one day God will make things right. And we can split over these things. We can fight over those things. But I think so often when we do these things, when we fight over it, we're missing the point. And we can fight over these things and actually not do the things that Jesus has called us to do. And Jesus himself said this in verse 36. About that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. If you think you know when all these things are going to happen, if you think you've got it locked in and you're willing to fight with some other brother or sister in the church over this, then you're saying you're smarter than Jesus. And maybe that is reason to separate. No, that's not reason to separate. But it's you don't know. You don't. We don't. But here's the thing that I want to challenge us all to this morning. Is that when we think we know when Jesus is coming back, and we think that it's coming, that he's coming back in our lifetime, it may affect how we live. So last time when I preached and I talked about the end times, after the service, some of us had discussions about why people are so interested in end times. Why are they so worried about naming when Jesus will come back? And one of the things that we talked about was many people are worried about their own mortality. We fear death. And you know what? I get that. We don't know what happens when our heart stops beating and our brain stops functioning. But again, I trust God. But I get that there would be people that are hoping that Jesus comes back before they die. I get that. But here's the thing. When we believe that Jesus is coming back before we die, it affects our discipleship as well, how we follow Jesus. One of the big things I remember from 20 years ago, my goodness, 20 years ago, Y2K. Yep, end of the world is coming with the turn of the calendar. Because Jesus was born 2,000 years ago, people believed that the end of the world was going to occur and Jesus is going to come back in the year 2000. Well, I'm just going to give you all a warning now. Are you ready for it? Because it's not Y2K. People are going to start saying it's Y2OK. It doesn't matter. Year 2030. Not when Jesus was born, but 2,000 years after Jesus died, that he'll be coming back. Prepare yourself. People are going to start predicting that. It's not my prediction, but people will start saying 2030, end of the world. So how would that affect the way people live? If we only have 10 more years, if we know we only have 10 more years, well, guess what? We have enough clean water to get by until then. Yeah, we don't have to worry about the environment. Those polar ice caps, they may be melting, but in 10 years, oh, this is going to burn anyways. People aren't going to be worried about trees. We have enough trees to get us by for another 10 years. And what about sickness and world hunger? Right now, today is International AIDS Awareness Day. Well, you know what? With modern medication, people can survive 10 years with HIV. What about cancer? Well, sure, we're going to lose some people, but why worry about illness? And why worry about global poverty if all this is just going to be gone in 10 years? You see where I'm going with this? If you believe that the world is going to end and end soon, you don't worry about those things. But you know why I think we should worry about things like the environment and global health concerns and global hunger? You know why I think we should worry about these things? Well, that's one reason, and because Jesus said to. I don't mean to overthink it. Jesus said to do it. And you know what else? Jesus did this. Was Jesus worried about sickness? Yeah. He went around and healed people. Was Jesus worried about hunger? I think so. Was Jesus worried about the environment? Absolutely. He walked everywhere. He never drove. Thank you. What I'm trying to say is Jesus knew that those people that he fed, you know, what's the problem with feeding the hungry? They get hungry again. I mean, I've got kids. I know that. You feed the kids, they're hungry again in 5 minutes. You feed somebody who's hungry, they get hungry again. Somebody that's sick, people that Jesus healed, guess where they are today? Well, they died. They're not still around. So you can care for somebody, medical personnel. You can do all you can. You can prolong people's existence. Even if you cure cancer, that person is still going to die. So why did Jesus do these things? Why did he heal the sick and feed the hungry if he knew they're just going to get hungry and sick again? Well, here's where those other big words come in that I have in your bulletin. What I want to say is that Jesus is living out the age that is to come. He's giving a taste of the end of times. So the first big word, I've shared these words with you before, but sometimes it's good to have some reinforcement. As much as it doesn't look like it, that is a English word. That is the word eschaton. Everybody say eschaton. The study of the eschaton is called eschatology. If you use it as an adverb or an adjective, I guess it'd be eschatological. Yeah, I know. That's what makes my day fun. All right, so the eschaton is simply the final stage in the divine plan. It is the end of times. So the eschaton is when Jesus comes back and makes things right. The other big word, I've shared this with you before, is the word proleptic. Now everybody say proleptic. Proleptic simply means to live as if a future event has already occurred. So when Jesus goes around and he's healing the sick and he's feeding the hungry, he's not doing it because he doesn't know these people are going to die. He doesn't do it because he knows these people are never going to get hungry again. What he's doing is he is proleptically embodying the eschaton. He is living as if the end times have already occurred. He is using his knowledge of what will come. A day will come when there's no hunger, when there's no sickness, when there's no pain or suffering. And he's living that out in his body at the time. So here's how I say it. Jesus proleptically embodied the eschaton, living out the kingdom of God here and now. And the way the church has often said this, that this is the already but not yet aspect of the kingdom. All right, your heads are hurting. Let's get practical. What time does it get dark now? Like noon? I'll say the benediction today is going to be dark. Those of you that work a 9-to-5, a traditional 9-to-5, you probably leave work and it's dark. You're driving home in the dark. Is that about right? If it's not dark when you leave, it's soon is dark afterwards. I despise that. I cannot get anything done. And not only can I not get things done, it affects me mentally. When the days get shorter, I get a little depressed. I get a little bit down. In part because I'm not able to do the things I want to do. But there's something just about the sunshine itself that I think I don't know, maybe there's medical personnel here that could explain it better than I can. Something about the sunshine makes me happy. Like, that's why people go to the beach, I think. I don't know why people go to the beach. I'm not a beach person. But people do that and it makes them happy. Something about the sunshine. When we have shorter days, it affects not just me, but I'm sure many of you here as well, mentally. There is a practice in some churches to have what is called a longest night service. The shortest day of the year, do you know which day that is? It's usually December 21st. It's the winter solstice. So the shortest day of the year also means the longest night. That's why they call it a longest night service. These churches will often gather on December 21st, and they have a chance to come together to mourn, to come together to share some of their struggles and some of their concerns, to actually lament with one another the things that haven't gone the way they've wanted them to go in their life, the struggles that they're seeing in their friends and in their families and in the greater world today. And I think it sounds kind of strange to us, right? Why would you get together just to lament something? But if you think about the Bible, if you think about the Psalms, a large portion of the Psalms are Psalms of lament. And something has happened in our society where we don't do this anymore. And it's not a part of what we are or who we are. We have this world where we have Instagram houses. You take a few pictures of your house and you post them online. And this is my perfect life. The Facebook families, everything, we've got it all together. My 2.5 kids or whatever is average with the dog and the perfect looking family. That's not reality. So I applaud those that come together and have these longest night services a chance to lament. And I think it's something we as a church should probably do a lot more of. We could do more lamenting because the world at times is quite dark. I'm going to skip one story and move ahead to a different story. Because even in the darkness, there's still hope. I have mentioned a guy here before. I've met him a few times. He's a writer, and some of you have read his books as well. His name is Benjamin Corey. Those of you that have read the books maybe know some of his work. Benjamin Corey, an author, a public speaker, all-around good guy, he shared one time on his blog about an experience that he had. And I tried to go back and find this blog post. I couldn't. I wondered if he removed it because of the personal nature of this story. But Benjamin Corey, 20 years ago, he entered into the military. He went and he fought in the Gulf Wars. Came back from this experience, and he moved back to his home community in Maine. And moved back on the family farm. So if you've been paying attention at all to agricultural trends, you know that there's not a lot of money in farming these days. Maybe there never was. He moved on to his parents' dairy farm. And I, for one, can tell you that there is no money and dairy farming. So Benjamin Corey, this young 20-something-year-old, comes back from the Middle East after fighting in this war. He moves onto the dairy farm. He's trying to make a living. There's no money in it whatsoever. He's in that stage of life where he wants to begin a family, but it's not working out the way he had expected. One thing adds up to onto another thing and another thing after that, and eventually he really finds himself in a bad place, in a dark place. And he shares the story how when he was discharged from the army, he was allowed to take with him his service handgun. I don't even know if that's something that you're supposed to do. I don't think you're supposed to. I don't think it's normal. But when he went when he left the army, he was given this handgun as part of his discharge. And he said one night he had written a letter. He had surrounded his living room with newspaper. And he took that military service weapon, and he was ready to terminate his demons. For some reason, he decided not to do it. He couldn't go through with it. He had prepared everything he could, but couldn't pull that trigger. And I, for one, am really glad he didn't. One, because I believe in that every life is precious, but also because he has touched so many people because of that. He has written books. He has gone around the world speaking and sharing his story. And he came out of that experience, I think, a better person. But one of the beautiful things that he did was, as he's developing and changing and growing, he actually is now a part of a Mennonite church. He sees himself as an Anabaptist. And he ran into this group called Raw Tools. I've shared about raw tools before. Raw tools takes handguns and rifles, and what they do is they gather them together, and these experienced blacksmiths take these handguns and they transform them into gardening tools. Here's just a few of the examples that you'll find raw tools making. They melt down the metal and they forge them into things that you can use to till the dirt, to till the earth. And when Ben Corey heard about raw tools, he took that service weapon that he had almost used to kill himself and he transformed it into a garden trowel. A weapon once intended to take life was now being used to give life. And the reason that they do this is they base it on the scripture, again, that Paxton read. Isaiah 2:4b says this: "They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore." Now, my friends, I know some people are out there thinking this sounds very utopian. It's not that easy. We don't just beat a few guns into a gardening tool and everybody's happy. You know, not everybody is going to stop and not commit suicide because of this thing that you do with a tool or a gun, whatever it might be. I know it sounds utopian. I know it sounds a little wishy-washy. But think of it like this. How many of you have ever been to a blacksmith shop, a for real blacksmith shop? Several of you have. If you go to the Frontier Culture Museum, you can see an actual person in there banging on metal, making nails and latches. And if you've been to that one, what are the two things you notice when you walk in? It is hot and dirty. Absolutely. Those are the two things I was going for. It is hot and it is dirty. If you tell that blacksmith that he has an easy job, especially the one that's dressed up in that traditional garb at the Frontier Culture Museum, he is probably not going to be your best friend. I think it is a good metaphor for what we as the church are called to do. You know, we have a lot of hard work to do. We are called to heal the sick and feed the hungry and bang those guns into plowshares and swords into plowshares and make pruning hooks out of spears. Nobody said it's going to be easy work. You're going to come out of it stinky and you're going to come out of it sweaty and it might not be pleasant. But we're called to do the difficult work. We're called to sit with people in these challenging times. So when Benjamin Corey sits down with a friend and they look over at his desk and he's got sitting there a trowel with a pistol grip on it, he has a story to share with them. And what he's doing is not saying that, you know what, by having this pistol grip trowel on my desk, that it's going to end all suicide, it's going to end all poverty or anything like that. What he's trying to do is just simply embody the eschaton. He is proleptically embodying that which will come. I'll close with one more story. A friend of mine, another friend, started a ministry in North Carolina. And this ministry intentionally ministered to the poor. So you can imagine the kind of funds that they had. They didn't have a lot of money. But one of the things they tried to do was try to pay bills for people when they can, try to provide rides to people to and from the doctors, things of that nature. Well, this friend of mine, he had reached out to this one guy and they paid this number of bills for him, but they had their limits because it's a small ministry. And this person called up my friend and he said, "Hey, my electric's getting cut off today. Is there anything that you can do to help me?" And my friend was absolutely heartbroken because he couldn't help this person. But what he told him was, "No, I can't pay your electric bill. But what I will do is I'll come sit with you in the dark." My friend, sometimes the best thing we can do as a church is to sit with people in the dark. And I believe that when we do sit with people in the dark, and we all have those periods of darkness, we are embodying the future that is to come. As followers of Jesus Christ, we are called to proleptically embody the future, to live out that promise that every knee will bow, every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, that people will come from far and near, doesn't matter their race, their ethnicity, or their background, all will be drawn to the temple of God, where there will be no more hunger, there will be no more pain, there will be no more suffering. We are to embody that today, not because people don't get hungry again, but because one day all will be made right. In our Advent sermon time, we will close each sermon with a confession. So I invite you to join me. You read the people part, and I'll read the leader. First me. Forgive me, Lord, for not expecting you. Forgive me, Lord, for being asleep. Forgive me, Lord, for my carelessness. Forgive me, Lord, for failing to see you. Blessed be our God who invites us to walk in the light of the Lord. Amen.